Morning, everyone. This is time to start the Joint Judiciary Committee today, finally, finish this out. But starting off for our agenda this morning, I'd like to call Sandra Hansberger, David Thornburg, and Ed Harden. Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Olson and Vice Chair, and Vice Chair Starr. My name is Sandra Hansberger, and I am the Executive Director of the Lawyers Campaign for Equal Justice. And I'd also like to present David Thornburg, who's the Executive Director of the Oregon Law Center, and Ed Herndon to my right, who is the Board Chair of the Lawyers Campaign for Equal Justice. I'm here really to talk about some of the civil legal needs of the poor in Oregon. Mr. Thornburg is going to talk to you about the challenges that legal aid offices face when trying to serve the civil legal needs of the poor. And Mr. Herndon is going to talk with you a little bit today about the Lawyers Campaign for Equal Justice and how we try to help solve some of the problems that have arisen for lack of resources for legal aid. As I'm sure all of you know, legal aid offices provide free legal services to low-income individuals for clients across the state. And they're nonprofit organizations that receive diverse funding. And I'm going to take my testimony a bit out of order and talk a little bit first about some of the funding picture for legal aid offices. In the back of my testimony on page 4, I have a pie chart that really talks about the various and varied sources of funding for legal aid. As you can see, that probably the largest part of funding for legal aid comes from state filing fees. Another large portion of funding comes from the Federal Legal Services Corporation, and other funding comes from the Oregon Law Foundation and the Campaign for Equal Justice. You'll see over to the left side of the pie chart, there are a variety of different funding sources, which, and my understanding is that there are approximately 70 different grant funding sources that help provide funding for legal aid. So we're really working with a diverse source of funding, sources of funding. David Thornburg will talk to you a little bit about the declining federal funding and the crisis that really caused lawyers in Oregon to work together to help increase funding for legal aid and the work that the legislature has done to help increase funding for civil legal services and access to justice. I did want to talk to you for just a few minutes about some typical cases that are being handled by legal aid. And we have also passed out a copy of our newsletter, and on the front bottom of the newsletter is a picture of a legal aid client named Tammy, who is from Chiloquin, Oregon. Tammy's case is somewhat typical of cases that legal aid sees. Tammy specifically was in an abusive marriage for about 23 years. The fact that she's from Chiloquin, it's located, as you probably know, in Klamath County, was difficult for Tammy to be able to get services to escape, legal services to escape the domestic violence. After about 23 years, her husband was finally jailed for, I believe, attempted murder, very serious assault on her. Tammy was ultimately able to get some assistance from the Bend Legal Office, who helped her in obtaining a divorce. The importance of obtaining a divorce for her was to resolve matters of custody for her minor child, who's also listed in the picture. Legal aid could help with that. Unfortunately, at the end of the divorce, Tammy found out that she had a very aggressive form of cancer and was concerned about what might happen to her child in the event of her death. And the Bend office was unable to help her with estate-type issues, so they were able to find a pro bono lawyer to assist with that part of her case. We have given you in our testimony also some samples of client stories from around the state. And in my testimony, I also spoke about, my written testimony, I'm sorry, I also spoke about some of the cases we can't handle. I think the important thing is to recognize that for every case like Tammy's, there are four other people who are unable to get service. The 2000 study that was commissioned by the Oregon State Bar, the Oregon Judicial Department, and the Office of the Governor found that we're meeting less than 20% of the legitimate legal needs of the poor in Oregon. The sad news is that a study that was done in 2005 last summer confirmed that we're still meeting less than 20% of the civil legal needs of the poor in Oregon. Legal aid offices serve directly about 20,000 clients each year. And other clients are helped, and we try to stretch those resources by helping clients with classes, pro se materials, pro bono representation, and websites. So there are lots of efforts going on to try to stretch those resources. I'd like to turn this over to David Thornburg at this point, who can talk to you a little bit more about actually how we deliver the services in Oregon. Yes?
Sandra, I'm just curious. What was the cost? Just the bottom...
The overall cost of providing this statewide network of legal services in Oregon is about $12.7 million per year. We've estimated that we need about $386,000 each year to keep stable funding or just to keep up with inflation. And I should have, I apologize that I did not introduce Tom Matsuda, who's also in the room over here. Tom is the Executive Director of Legal Aid Services of Oregon.
My name is David Thornburg. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Law Center, one of the statewide nonprofits that provide legal services to the poor. And I've been a legal aid lawyer since 1979. The biggest problem that we have in Oregon is we have such a large geographical area. And so many low-income individuals scattered across the state. So we have limited funding, and the secret is how do you try to create a delivery model to maximize access to civil legal services for the poor. Our current model is based on a study that was done in 1971. Governor Tom McCall called for the study, and the State Bar, in consultation with the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, sponsored this study. They recommended that we set up regional offices, as we have done across the state, to try to maximize access. There have been two additional Blue Ribbon Commissions, one in 1996 and one in 2004, both of which were chaired by Steve Walters, and we continue to implement the recommendations of those commissions. The one in 1971 was written by an attorney named Don Marmaduke and also Charlie Williamson, who were still very active in the bar and have been strong supporters of legal services during that entire period. We employ 95 attorneys, and we have offices in 17 communities. So I want to just unfold this map so you have a visual image of the communities in Oregon. Could you help me with this, Sam?
And so we have officers in Ontario, Hamilton.
David, could you speak in the mic a little bit?
You didn't trust me with this.
I got you.
Thank you for helping me.
You look heavier on that end.
We have offices in Ontario and Pendleton, Albany, Bend, Coos Bay, Eugene, Grants Pass, Hillsboro, McMinnville, Medford, Newport, Oregon City, Portland, Roseburg, Salem, and Woodburn. Two of these offices are county-wide programs. The history of legal services is that they were created by state and local bar associations because attorneys understood the importance of having access to justice for low-income people. And many of these programs merged over time, but the program in Medford and in Lane County are still independent. We work extremely closely with them as a coordinated group to try to provide better services for the poor. There are still major gaps in our current system. If you look at this map, you can see a large gap in Klamath Falls. People have to travel to Bend or Medford to receive service. I'm happy to report that due to a generous one-time grant from the Oregon Law Foundation, which gets money from interest rates on lawyer trust accounts, we're able to open a new office there. And we're in the process of doing that. It's very exciting. It's very important for the community. The Columbia River Gorge area, people from Hood River and the Dalles have to travel to Portland or to Pendleton to receive service. On the North Coast, people from Astoria and Tillamook are served out of Hillsborough. These are major gaps in our service delivery system. One of the hardest parts about working as a legal services lawyer is we cover such large geographical areas. Take the Ontario office, for example. You can see that large square in the lower right to the map. That office serves 20,000 square miles. It's larger than the states of Connecticut and Massachusetts together. We have three attorneys in that office serving the low-income individuals. They do outreach to Baker City, to Burns, sometimes difficult in the winter. We have a strong commitment to keeping rural offices open because our philosophy is that our legal services providers need to be part of the community. They need to be going to the soccer games and the churches and the community events in each community. It's not acceptable to try to send legal aid lawyers out of Portland to represent the poor. Oregon has made that commitment and has a larger number of offices in rural communities than most states, and it's an important part of the principle of who we are and how we want to serve clients. As I said, there are 95 legal aid lawyers across the state. We represent 1% of the Oregon State Bar. We are responsible for serving 16% of the people in Oregon. About 600,000 people are eligible for our services. There's one lawyer for every 340 Oregonians. There's one legal aid lawyer for every 6,600 low-income individuals. As Sandy explained, we set our priorities based on local priority setting process. What that means is we go out to the judges, to the social service agencies in each of the communities, to the low-income individuals in those communities, and we ask them, what should our highest priorities be? Because we know we can only serve 2 in 10 of those who have incredible legal needs. We're talking about basic life necessities. The ability to be safe in your home against domestic violence, child abuse, or sexual assault. We're talking about access to medical care, to housing, to food, basic necessities. And in each of those communities, we set local priorities based on what those communities say are the most important needs in that community. About 40% of the cases are family law. Almost all of those involve domestic violence. We are efficient and effective. As nonprofits, we're stretching the dollars to the maximum extent possible. We use 800 numbers, hotlines, classrooms, websites to try to make our services accessible across the state because we believe each Oregonian, no matter where that person lives, each low-income person, ought to have relatively equal access to justice. And we're responsible for that. It is our job to use our scarce resources wisely. As Sandy said, we have experienced severe reductions in federal funding. There's a chart on the second page of my written testimony that will show you that as recently as 1980, 80% of our funding was from the federal government, and now it's closer to 20%. We've been forced to go out and be creative and innovative in seeking additional funds, and we've been successful in diversifying our funding base. We learned just yesterday that it's likely that our funding will be flat at the federal government in this coming year. Each year we have more low-income people that we have to serve. Although the poverty rate in Oregon is not increasing dramatically, the number of human beings who live in poverty increases every year because of our increasing population overall. As Sandy said, we need to have $380,000 a year just to keep up with inflation. And so when we receive flat funding from large sources, it's very difficult for us to maintain our fragile network. Bill Hardin is going to talk to us about the Campaign for Equal Justice and the incredible efforts that the private bars made to support legal services and the services we deliver.
Well, I appreciate that, Chair Burdick, Chair Olson, members of the committee. I've had the pleasure of...
Could you just for the record mention your name?
I'm Ed Harnden. I'm the chair of the Campaign for Equal Justice Board and a member of the State Bar. And I have had the pleasure of being here on several bar issues over a period of time. And some of them you got right, and some of them you didn't. But this is a little different issue, I think. This is one of those situations where the State Bar and the lawyers in the State Bar have sat down and said, what kind of issue are we dealing with? Is this an issue just for lawyers, which I think the answer is no. But they have taken it on as really a moral obligation. That's a core value of the professional responsibility of lawyers in the state. I also think that it's a core value of all of us to support an access to justice issue, so we are able to say the justice system is not just for lawyers or not just for legislators or the judges. It is for everyone to have that access, and it shouldn't be a money issue. Can you hire me in my nice office in Portland, or you can get someone who really knows what they're doing, which are the legal aid lawyers. But it is a moral obligation, and what we did was to sit down and say, that's all nice and good, but quite frankly, I'm not going to go down to the legislature or go to the Congress and D.C. and say, we'd like your money or the public's money, unless we've stepped up to the plate and figured out a way, are we going to support it? And in fact, that's what the lawyers have done. Starting in 1991, we started with a campaign that included a matching grant from the Fred Meyer Foundation, which I have been told by them that they gave in part because a large number, because they didn't think we could make it with lawyers, which I find very unfair. But we did make it. And over the last few years, we've collected $12 million from lawyers. Last year's campaign from hundreds, in fact thousands of lawyers, we collected $1 million. And about $300,000 in grants along with that, which means that, in fact, the lawyers are stepping up to the plate. I was fortunate to chair the study a few years ago, which found that we, in fact, were only providing the services necessary to 20% of the people. And that survey was a broad survey throughout the state, which is where I think you should expect us to be as legislators. It's not a Portland issue. It's not an I-5 issue. It is a statewide issue. And as you saw from the map, providing those services is more difficult when you get into the rural areas to provide the numbers and the service. The prioritization is a requirement of almost every lawyer that we talk to when we're raising funds and going out and breaking arms and doing those things you do to get those funds. What they want to see is that the legal aid is being efficient, that legal aid is servicing on a priority basis those needs that are the most necessary, and we are able to give them that guarantee. And it's a bipartisan issue, which is important not only to you folks, but important to lawyers and everyone else, that this is that moral core value that we promise everyone when we say the judicial system is there, and the judicial system is there to take care of these needs. We have been extremely fortunate to have members of Congress supporting us. The Oregon delegation is unanimous in every year supporting an amount for a legal services corporation that helps us get to a larger percentage. And this legislature has been excellent, I believe, in its support on a bipartisan basis of saying, yes, it is. You should expect us to continue as a campaign to raise those funds from the attorneys. You should expect us to make sure we're prioritizing, and we are really pleased. We'd be happy to answer questions, but we want to make make sure that you know that we're out there doing the job we have told you before that we will do. We will continue to do that and do it in a manner which I think speaks well for Oregon, and we truly appreciate your support in making sure that happens throughout the state. Thanks.
Any questions? Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. One more thing. I wanted to express my gratification and thank you for the strong support this committee and this legislature has given to our efforts. We really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I must have seen that another time.
Thank you. I want to welcome my half of the committee. I just got out of my sick bed to be down here today, so don't anybody get too close to me, but I will formally bring the Senate Judiciary Committee to order at this time. And I don't see Joe O'Leary in the audience, so I hope he's on his way down to give our presentation on the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. While we're waiting for Joe to get here, I just want to let people know that my wonderful co-chair, Representative Krieger, is going into surgery today. He diagnoses his condition as liberalism of the esophagus, otherwise known as acid reflux. it usually does get a laugh, he tells me. He's in very good spirits, and it's more of a preventive operation than something life-threatening. So he's in a hospital in Coquille and expects to be out and about on Friday or Saturday, with big plans to come back to Salem next week, which I told him he really needs to reconsider that since we're not spring chickens anymore. He's in very good shape. So we have Joe O'Leary. Joe, do you hear me? On the agenda right now. We will take a a pleasure break here.
Do you want to go into recess? Or no?
And we will go in.
Well,
here's Joe now.
There's Joe. Too late, Joe. You've been superseded on the agenda.
Don't go away.
So we're not going to go to recess. We're going to have this on the record. And we are going, we have a little token of our appreciation for our honorable vice chair, who has done a wonderful job as vice chair of Judiciary, Senator Starr. And we have this little token from the committee and a little card for you.
Thank you very much.
Wow. Madam Chair.
Senator Pazansky.
And for the record, I know I, for one, will be missing Senator Starr and his breads that he always brings every morning. I was thinking coming up this morning, should I be eating? I said, no, I want to run the chance again that Senator Starr will take care of me. Sure, he did.
Well, Senator Pazansky, I made the same decision. I'm going to wait a respectable time and then have breakfast with Senator Starr's famous pumpkin bread. And every time he makes it, it turns out better than the last time. And I don't know. I think that's why he eventually had to quit, because he couldn't keep up the continual improvement of his pumpkin bread. Just rip it off.
All right.
I'm closer to this area than I am that, that's for sure.
That's the back.
That's the back. Now I can serve my pumpkin bread.
That's right, and that's exactly what this platter is for, to give the proper due to Senator Starr's wonderful pumpkin bread, which is also very healthy. Mix it with whole wheat flour and olive oil. I have it in good authority. Anyway, thank you very much, Senator Starr, for your wonderful service. Okay, now we will move into Joe O'Leary's presentation on the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act, and I can't believe we only gave you a half hour on this, but talk fast, Joe.
Chair Burdick, I can take considerably less time if it would please the committee. I'm happy to be here today. For the record, my name is Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski for Public Safety Matters, and it's a pleasure to be here this morning to speak to you about the Walsh Act. The road that brought me to testify today really began with the Judiciary Committee's interim work group on sex offenders and sex offender registration issues. Representative McPherson and Representative Krieger, Senator Burdick, and Senator Beyer met on several occasions with Bill Taylor, counsel to the committee, and myself, initially as counsel to the committee, and then later as the governor's representative. And the topic of those meetings were looking at some general themes in Oregon statutes relating to sex offender registration issues, relief from registration, and some sex crime issues. And as the course of those discussions went on, the Congress passed the Walsh Act in August of 2006, and the President signed the act. The act itself is a it's big and complicated. It's 700 pages long, and I'm going to give you a couple of highlights that are at the highest level of the overview of the act. But the long and the short of it is that with the passage of this federal legislation, there are quote-unquote requirements to the states that are pinned to potential penalties financial penalties in Criminal Justice Act grant awards if the states do not implement those changes. So what happened at the Judiciary Committee's work group level was the questions started to come up, should we continue talking about what we're talking about in Oregon law, the potential changes to Oregon law with respect to sex offender issues, or are the concepts we're talking about mooted out by the passage of the Walsh Act? I took that issue back to the governor, and the governor asked me to gather a group of the affected executive branch agencies at the staff level to determine a couple of things, and here are our goals. One is, what does the act require? Two is, what changes would need to be made in Oregon statutes to implement the act? Three is, what is the cost, the fiscal cost, to the state to comply with the act and make those changes? Four is, what is the cost, again, the fiscal cost, not to comply with the act? And five is, what is the public safety benefit? And that is the biggest big picture policy question you can ask. And that's obviously a question that cannot only be resolved at the staff level or in one branch of government. So those are the charges that I set out to try to accomplish with representatives of the affected agencies. And I'm going to talk to you about some of the issues that came up. First, let me double back and give you the high level review of what the act, the federal act, requires. There are a couple of things. I mentioned it's 700 pages. A whole lot of that does not apply to the states at all. In fact, a good portion of that creates new federal crimes that are only applicable in federal court to people charged with federal crimes. However, a significant portion of the act speaks to the state's regulations of convicted sex offenders and imposes or would impose upon states that decide to comply with the act a different registration model than exists in, I believe, any state currently in the country. The model is a three-tier reporting system. This is what the Walsh Act requires states to comply with or face financial penalties. The three-tier reporting system is offense-based. That is, it is pinned to specifically named offenses in the federal law. And it is the three different tiers have different timings. That is, the first tier, folks who are, and this is a low-level offense, the folks who are convicted of that list of offenses are required to report and register annually. The second tier, moderate level, for lack of a better word, offenses, are required to report every 3 months. And the third tier, which is the highest, again, for lack of a better word, offense tier, are required to report every 3 months. By way of context, the Oregon model and most other states require annual reporting regardless of the crime conviction.
Can I interrupt for half a second? You said that both the moderate and the high tier report every 3 months?
I didn't mean to, excuse me, Chair Burdick. I meant to say the moderate tier is every 6 months, okay, and the highest tier is every 3 months. Appreciate to you. I'm using those low, moderate, and high. That's Joe O'Leary interpretation of the Act. The Act does not use those terms.
I assume high would be the predatory.
Well, and you raise a really good question, Chair Burdick. The fact is that the different tiers are based on the crimes of conviction only. And this, you're touching on a big issue, because a lot of there's been a lot of talk about looking for ways to impose risk-based measures on registration and on supervision, for that matter. And my initial review of the law, of this federal law, is that is not where it's going. It is basically the nature of the offense. And what I believe happened is Congress picked policy choices over what they think. If you are convicted, I'm going to give you an example. I don't know if this is what's in the Act, but for example, if you are convicted of a misdemeanor level sex offense, like a sex abuse 3, a unconsented to sexual touching, someone made a policy decision that only requires annual registration. Whereas if you were convicted of, say, a rape 1, a forcible compulsion rape, if someone made a policy decision that requires every 3 months registration and check-in. So that's the model, if you will, that the Act puts into place. The Act also puts into place a requirement that all registered offenders' information be posted on the Internet. And as you know, that is not current Oregon law. Under current Oregon law, it is predatory sex offenders whose information is required to be posted on the Internet. And it also includes different information that registry is required to provide to the public than current Oregon law. It increases the penalties that states must impose on individual sex offenders who fail to register according to that system. And it also requires specific procedures that I do not know the details of yet for background checks for adoptive and foster placements. So I'm giving you those kind of points are the highest level of the highlights. And I mentioned to you that probably every other state in the country is looking at this right now as we are, trying to figure out what the language of the statute means to the state. And the U.S. Department of Justice, I should mention, is scheduled to release implementation guidelines. They're going to publish in the Federal Register because of all the questions that they have received from the states. You know, what does this mean for us? How do we apply this to our state law? What's the conversion of a conviction that's listed under Tier 1 that may or may not exist under state law? How do we make that equivalent to state law? Lots of issues, and some of those questions are hopefully going to be answered when the federal government posts those guidelines that are anticipated later this month. I should also mention that there have been some national law enforcement conferences, one of which was attended by representatives from the Oregon State Police, where this became the topic of conversation. As you can imagine, other states, state police organizations like Oregon's, are the custodian of the registry. And at this time, just to give you some context, Oregon has 13,000, this is as of the end of October, 13,426 registered sex offenders that do not count the persons who are currently incarcerated, by the way. So those are that is the population and growing population that we're talking about. So it's a potentially significant administrative issue, just at the very basic level of who's the custodian of those records and what responsibilities do they have to maintain those. I mentioned to you the goals of those five goals that I have with this staff level work group of executive branch agencies, and what I want to let you know is that we have, because of the scope of this act and the detail that's required to figure this out, we have counsel assigned from the Department of Justice to assist us and basically staff the group. And I'm very pleased about that. Mr. Taylor has joined us in our initial meeting, as is Kate Toswell from the Legislative Council's office, and as has a representative from the Judicial Department. We have all branches of government represented, at least in this conversation. But again, our goal, our preliminary goal, is to bring to the governor and bring to you for policy discussions a concise summary of what this federal legislation requires the state to do if it is to comply. And then secondarily, what the cost would be to comply. And then finally, to engage in a discussion with you about the policy benefits of complying or not. So I'm happy to run through. There are about 12 or 13 kind of preliminary issues that when we sat down initially, the group just kind of threw these things against the wall and decided that these were the first dozen or so things that we really needed to figure out and what this act means. I can tell you, though, that we're not going to even try to get to the answers to that until after the DOJ guidelines come out in the Federal Register.
Before you would like to hear those issues, but before you do that, does the federal law dictate that the registration has to be permanent? That there's no process for
Chair Murdoch, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that question.
Because one of the things we were discussing in the sex offender work group is figuring out some of the non-forcible lower-level crimes.
What I can tell you, Chair Burdick, is that the issue of what effect this would have if it were adopted by Oregon on the process that Oregon has for relief from registration for both adults and juveniles, because under current law we have two different processes in place, and that is one of these initial dozen or so issues that we identified. Again, this is like the worst
segue
of law school issue spotting, if you will. Where we look at a problem and we say, okay, how many different issues can we spot and who can we assign to try to find the answers? And that is a big one.
Great. Did you have a question?
Yeah. Can you give a sense for the governor's office whether you will submit legislation in this session or 09 to implement the act?
Chair Burdick, Representative Ackerman, I do not know the answer to that yet. And I think that the reason I don't know the answer to that and that I'd be reticent to commit is that we need to do more homework on what changes the act would require, and we need to look at that cost-benefit analysis both on the financial end and on the public safety end, and engage in that discussion with the legislature about whether it is a good policy choice or not. The other thing I should mention along those lines is that the act provides a period of 3 years for states to comply. So we do have some time, and I think that is out of recognition that it is a very broad, sweeping sort of thing. So we have some time to look at it.
Thank you.
Would you like me to hit the list of issues that we generated?
Please do.
The first one is this distinction between risk-based registration and offense-based registration. And the committee will recall earlier discussions both in your informational meeting on sex offenders back in February and in some of our informal discussions over the course of the interim that there's been a lot of talk about moving toward a risk-based analysis. There's even some talk, I'm getting off subject, but there's even some talk about moving toward risk-based analysis in sentencing that was directed by the committee and the legislature in the form of the bill, I want to say it was Senate Bill 919, that asked the Criminal Justice Commission to do some analysis on that issue. So that is one of the primary issues that we're looking at. Does the act preclude a state from implementing a risk-based registration model? The second issue is comparing the conviction equivalents. I mentioned to you that those tier system under the federal act is based on the underlying conviction. And what's going on is that the federal law will state a crime, like, for example, sexual abuse of a minor. And then someone's got to figure out what's the Oregon law equivalent to that crime, because Oregon doesn't have, you know, the same named crime. We need to look at elements. We need to figure out apples and apples and oranges to oranges. The next one is the failure to register as a sex offender criminal provision, that my read of it requires states to make failure to register as a sex offender a felony. And we need to drill down into that and figure out a little bit more, because our current scheme under Oregon law has failure to register as a misdemeanor if the underlying sex offense was a misdemeanor, and a felony if the underlying sex offense was a felony. The next topic that is very important is, what is the application of juveniles? Initial hint that we have is that the act is intended to apply to juveniles in total, and we need to drill down on that and make sure that is what's intended, and look at what changes that would require. And my belief is that would require a lot of changes in Oregon law, in the juvenile code, in the delinquency code at least. The next topic is the website issue, the internet posting requirement, and what changes that would require. The next issue is posting and community notification, which is a special provision of Oregon law. It is possibly not in the scope of the Watch Act, but we want to find out for sure. The next two issues are financial issues. There are funding incentives in the act, and we need to drill down on that and find out what they are. And this is statements in the act that suggest that funds will be appropriated to states who comply with the requirements of the act early. And we need to find out how much those funds are and what the manner in which states can apply and obtain those funds, and that's a very significant question. The next is the flip side of that question, which is, what are the funding penalties? And I mentioned to you that the act pins compliance to Byrne grant, which is the criminal justice grant monies. For example, some of those monies were directed by the governor last year to supplement the drug court grants that were approved in the meth bills. Those monies are used for domestic violence purposes, a lot of other criminal justice enforcement issues. And to give you a context on the Byrne grant funding, in 2006, the state of Oregon received $2.25 million dollars in Byrne grant funds, and the act indicates that states that fail to comply after 3 years would get dinged 10% off of the Byrne grant. I also note for you that the Byrne grant amount has been decreasing steadily over the last 10 years. $2.25 million this year around. Last year it was 3.6. The year before that it was 6.1. So that is something that again needs to be some facts need to be applied to that, and we need to see where the trajectory is. the impact on the Interstate Compact. There's the next issue. This is the laws that are in place by which offenders leaving Oregon who are sex offenders have to comply with certain requirements to be supervised in other states, and vice versa, offenders who are coming into Oregon from other states, certain requirements apply to them. Next topic is relief from registration, which the chair mentioned already. And we're getting to the end of the list. And here's a big one, retroactivity, which you'll... I mean, if you thought that the retroactivity issue was tricky in the Blakely discussion last session, I think it's only going to be more tricky applied to an issue like this. And that is one of the issues that I'm told by our folks at the Oregon Department of Justice that they are keeping their fingers crossed that that is one of the issues in the Federal Register guidelines that the Federal Department of Justice puts out. And then two more issues. One is the application of the Department of Human Services. I mentioned to you there's this foster care background check enhancement requirement and exactly what that is. And then finally, there is a section in the bill about civil commitment of sex offenders. This is not something that is part of Oregon law right now. Several other states have this, such as Washington, Wisconsin, and a handful of others, Alaska. And what this issue is some states have decided that when sex offenders who are not sentenced to life in prison are getting out of prison at the end of their sentence, that there ought to be a mechanism by which the state can move to civilly commit them in order to incapacitate them, and the theory is, you know, preventing them from having an opportunity to reoffend. And as I mentioned, Washington State has followed that, Wisconsin has followed that, and there are several others. I know that in prior sessions that this was a topic of discussion in the legislature, and I've learned from folks who were here long before me that the Oregon legislature, at least at one time, decided not to follow that road and instead put in place the sexually violent dangerous offender statute that requires lifetime supervision for certain sex offenders based on a risk-based analysis. But this could be an opportunity to reopen some discussion about that issue. And that's I'm ending the list, thankfully, but those are all, as you can imagine, I've alluded to and trying not to take the whole 30 minutes. Those are all really meaty issues, and it's going to take a lot of analysis and discussion even before we get into the policy debate of what's good for Oregon, what don't we need to do.
I think you said this before, but I missed it. When do we expect the Federal Register to come out?
Chair Burdick, the end of the month.
Chair Burdick.
Thank you, Chair. I didn't hear you mention it. I don't know if it's in it or not, but was there an opportunity for waivers or stuff like that, like there is in much of the welfare reform acts and stuff like that that Congress has done? States can apply for waivers for certain provisions if they do it another way?
Chair Burdick and Senator Beyer, very good question. I don't recall seeing the waiver issue that you're describing, and I'm familiar with how that works in the Medicaid world at a very high level. What I recall, and I will check into that and have our council look at that issue, what I do recall is that there is a provision by which any of the acts, the federal acts requirements that would be unconstitutional under the state's constitution are waived by matter of law. There is that provision, but I don't recall an application for a waiver.
That's actually an excellent question. I would nominate that for inclusion on your meaty issues.
Yes.
Are there other questions for the committee? Thank you very much. You came in under...
Actually, if I could, Mr. O'Leary, I'm wondering about if you could generalize about the cost-benefit impacts of this legislation. That is, are the things that it is requiring as new actions, how do they compare in cost to the new resources that are available from the federal government?
Yeah.
Chair Burdick and Representative McPherson, I I'm going to dodge the question respectfully. I don't want to speculate at this time, but I think that what you've touched on is the purpose of this staff level work group that we have put together, and it is to identify what the act requires, to identify what the fiscal impact is to if the state were to make those changes, and identify what the cost would be not to comply. So I think that on the purely on the financial side, we ought to be able to give for you a rough cost-benefit analysis. My hit right now is, and this is in the most general way, is that it is probably going to cost more to comply than it would not to comply. And I base that, and that's not a conclusion at this point. That is an early and again, very surface level look at this, but it requires deeper analysis. And I base that on the fact that there's 13,000 sex offenders in Oregon as of the end of last month that right now have to report annually to the state police or their supervising authority. This would require at least some of those folks to report every 3 months, and another group of those folks to report every 6 months. I'm putting up different fingers than I'm saying the numbers, and I'm sorry, I'm confusing myself. So ignore my fingers. 3 months and 6 months. So that is clearly going to be a significant financial increase. And what I don't know is how much money is available under the Act as incentives for the state, and how long that money is available as incentives for the state to comply with the Act. I also know that our burn grant funding is at $2.25 million, and it's been decreasing steadily over the course of the last 10 years. And if that trend continues, the 10% reduction that is the penalty, the stick that's imposed by the Walsh Act, you know, there is a point where that starts to, there's either some equilibrium there, or it doesn't pay to comply. But a separate issue from the fiscal one is the what's the public safety benefit, and that's a bigger policy question. And I think that's a policy question that the interim legislative work group began to discuss. You know, what is the benefit of registration? Is there a net public safety gain by registration every 6 months as opposed to every year? Is there a net public safety gain by registration every 3 months? Does it make sense to have that registration pinned to only the crime of conviction, or should there be a risk analysis that's pinned to? I think that this is kind of a can of worms, but it raises really good and valid questions all around that I think are going to inform us eventually once we get out of the woods on whether or not this is a good way to go.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Joe, I'm curious, how many other states right now are doing something similar to what you described with the three-tier, or the three different levels, especially every 3 months for the predator level kind of?
Chair Olson, the information that I have, which is anecdotal, is that no other states are currently complying with the Act. Again, further anecdotal information from folks who have had conversations at the federal level and folks who have attended national conferences that have discussed this is that there are many states who are indicating that they do not intend to comply with the Act. I don't know how many, and again, that's, you know, this is talk at a conference, so that may change. But to answer your question, I know of none that are currently doing this.
Joe, thank you. Joe, if no other states are complying anecdotally and there is no database, then how will we decide whether it is financially appropriate to do that compliance? I mean, it seems like it's a chicken or egg thing here. Where do you find the data to find out whether it... registering every 3 months will be more efficacious than once a year?
Chair Olson, Senator Whitsitt, good question. I think that the way we find out the fiscal impact in Oregon is we extrapolate what it costs on the registration side. We extrapolate what it costs to maintain the annual registration, and we figure out how many people it would apply to under the six-month rule and how many people it would apply to under the three-month rule, and we multiply it by those factors. So I think we could do it at that end in a vacuum. We could do a cost estimate. The efficacy question on public policy is a more difficult one to answer clearly. I think what we would need to do is look to law enforcement and public safety policy think tanks and journals and law enforcement organization, National Institute of Justice, and all of the resources that are available to us to have that discussion about the benefit of more frequent registration.
It was a good question. I find it very interesting. I mean, having had that experience, you know, being with the state police and having, you know, offenders come in and register, just trying to capture that. It's
the part here about the each state must provide a criminal penalty greater than 1 year imprisonment for a failure. I'm thinking of some person who's not really a threat, who had something that happened in the past, and they're not a very responsible person, so that we're obligated to put them in prison for a year or more. I don't know.
And if I could, Chair Wilson and Representative Barker, if I could respond, you touched on one of our major issues on this list, and the thing we want to find out on that issue is whether or not the Act requires that the failure to register be a felony for which a year in prison or more is the maximum possible sentence, or whether or not it requires a year in prison or more. And if the answer is the latter, then that will be put into the fiscal part of the calculation and better inform us of what that cost will be.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And obviously, I mean, we could sit down and talk about this all day long. Okay, Mr. Bob Jester. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Good morning. For the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am the director of the Oregon Youth Authority. And the Oregon Youth Authority was asked to come back before this body in December and report on the implementation and progress that the agency has made toward the implementation of the recommendations that were made by the Youth Safety Committee. And you may recall that this committee was brought together following the case of one of our probation parole staff who was arrested for sex abuse. And we convened an outside review group to look at the agency and make recommendations as to how we can improve the safety for youth as well as improve the services that we were providing. So this is a review of our implementation of those recommendations. And in your book, you have a 5-6 page outline, and let me start. There were 5 areas of recommendation that the Youth Safety Committee made. They were employment related, training related, policies and procedures, complaint response, and then a category that we titled other. So if you would turn the page to the recommendations on employment, I will walk you through what we have done in the implementation of those areas. On hiring, one of the the suggestions was that we standardize our process for hiring, and we have done that in a couple of ways. Number one, we have purchased a program called the Impact Scenario-Based Screening, and this is a program that was developed for law enforcement and also for corrections, valid both in facilities as well as in field. So all of our staff who are applicants take the scenario-based impact test, and we get a result from about 19 areas that show your high scores, medium scores, or low scores. And this helps us make appropriate hiring decisions using the test results as one of those new considerations. In the field, where our workers work more autonomously in carrying out their responsibilities and duties as juvenile parole officers, juvenile parole assistants, as well as our supervisors, we have gone to a psychological testing post-offer, pre-hire. So the process is that the individual would take the impact test, we go through the normal screening of the interview, as well as background check, and then if we were making the offer and the person accepted, it would be contingent on a satisfactory psychological test. That's an in-person test. We have contracted with a provider that is currently doing work in Multnomah County for the community justice, as well as does a couple of law enforcement agencies in the metro area for pre-employment screening. We have done one of those tests, and I took the opportunity to talk with the worker who was tested, asked him how he felt about that process, and he was, you know, it was absolutely fine. It was confidential. The content and what we received from the psychologist was appropriate for the responsibilities and duties of the job, or inappropriate. In this case, he was found to be appropriate.
Can I stand up for, excuse me, Mr. Chair? I'm not in charge.
Proceed.
Thank you. Because it's post-offer and pre actually getting the job, are there any concerns about liability doing that, since somebody knows that they qualify and then you have a psychological test? Did anybody raise concerns about liability?
Madam Chair, that is actually a very good question, and we worked both with organized labor. We worked to talk with our managers about this, and also DOJ. And the postings for the job indicate that this is the hiring process, and we name the psychological testing as part of that. And it is a satisfactory completion of all of those that would result in their appropriateness for the position. So it is offered, the information is given up front that that's part of it, and the offer is contingent upon them successfully completing a psychological. And that's how, as we researched other jurisdictions that are using psychological testing, that's how they do it. Thank you. In background investigations, we are currently working with Oregon State Police on a list of retired Oregon State Police officers that would be available to do background investigations on a contracted basis, and we have finalized the areas that we want included in that investigation, and we are currently developing those RFQs. In the training area, there was some criticism of the agency for not having designed a pre-service training for our juvenile parole officers. And these individuals were hired, selected, put to work, were being trained by fellow officers and a supervisor actually in the field. But from the time of hire, they were actually out there doing the work with a fair amount of responsibility. Now, recognizing that they had passed the qualifications, but they had not been formally trained. And we have very little attrition in the field, and therefore we had not focused a training curriculum for this group. That has changed. We now have a four-week curriculum that our JPPOs, juvenile parole probation officers, and juvenile parole assistants must satisfactorily complete before they begin their work and start the hands-on job with supervision of youth and community. The ongoing in-service training, we have refined that and included some of the elements that were recommended by the Safety Review Committee. Supervision, another one of the concerns that was expressed by this group was that our span of control for supervisors was too broad. Looking at other state agencies that are doing oversight of case management and looking at national standards, we're about 1 to 10, 1 to 11, and that was at about 1 to 7. What we have done is we have focused that supervision and we have prioritized through the evidence-based process of case management. And let me just briefly explain what that entails. When you come into our custody, we now do a risk need assessment. And from that risk need assessment, there is an identification of areas that that youth needs to work on to be successful. And those areas that he's going or she are going to work on become part of the case plan. And the case plan is actually what drives what happens with that individual case, when they go to foster care, where they're paroled back to parents, what their plan in the institution would be or their program. And that case plan is reviewed regularly by a multidisciplinary team. And the MDT, or multidisciplinary team, is actually a group of professionals, one of those being the parole officer themselves, parole supervisor. There are community members also involved in that. They are the ones that have oversight in the implementation of that case plan. So it is not the parole officer making decisions and implementing those in a vacuum of review and input from others, and the others are not all individuals from what's inside of our agency. If you turn to the page recommendations on training.
Here.
Yes.
Before we leave that area, I find it interesting. You made a statement that your agency is understaffed in management, 1 to 10 versus 1 to 7 industry-wide, yet I have had numerous employees, ex-employees, specifically from McLaren, come to me because I represent that area, and they tell me that McLaren is nothing but managers. There are no line workers left, and the way you get around inadequate training of line worker or staff workers is you make them managers, and then they don't need the training. So I don't understand why it is that I've got the people on the job telling me one thing, and you're coming here telling me you guys are short on management. How does that reconcile?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, the ratio that the Youth Safety Committee looked at was, in fact, our field supervisors, and that currently the Oregon Youth Authority is in a 1 to 10. In our institutions, we have one cottage manager that is responsible for all the staff that work into that living unit. And then there are some support supervisors. There is a superintendent at McLaren, and there are two program directors at McLaren. We have a food service manager, for example, a clinic manager, for example, a security manager, for example. But in the living units where the staff that you are referring to, the group life coordinators, work, there is one management person assigned.
I guess I'm going to have to get some pie charts or some employee charts and see what you call in management, what you're calling line workers, because according to people out there in the facility, that's not the case.
So what I sense is you're more concerned, I follow what's going on with some type of mandatory training to ensure that they're not sidestepping that.
Well,
is that what I'm getting?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I mean, the complaints and the information I've received from employees and former employees out there is that, number one, they're way overstaffed in management, and they're specifically at McLaren, and number two, if they have employees who are not sufficiently trained to do the job they were hired to do, they are made managers, so they don't need the requirement of training. They're just becoming a manager, and they're still not qualified to do the job, even though that's what they're supposed to be doing. So I think it's a two-pronged thing, but it seems that this report completely contradicts what I've heard from the people who work in the facility. So I'd like to have you present me with a chart showing your employment graph and who's what and what title they have.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'd be absolutely happy to. And again, the safety committee looked specifically at our field, did not look at our facility side, but I'd be happy to provide you that information and make those distinctions. And as we go through this report, I will talk about the management curriculum that our managers and supervisors are also participating in. So it's not an avoidance of training when a manager or supervisor is hired, be it at a facility and or in the field. They go through the same training that I described above, plus there is DAS management leadership training they also go through. But I'd be happy to provide you with that information.
Thank you. So, Rosalie.
Carol from Mr. Chester. The incident that precipitated this long conversation was with a then current employee of our news authority. Have you implemented or do you intend to implement any background checks or psychological testing of current employees to determine if there is any overt activity going on among long-term employees?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we have not undertaken that direction. We have started with new hires and promotions, and that would be a discussion that we would have with labor in the future if we were to begin a process of reviewing existing staff and adding requirements would be, a contract issue that we would need to undertake. But we have started with new hires and promotions.
Well,
proceed.
I'm troubled a little by that in that it seems that the purpose is to protect the young people who are incarcerated and being treated in your facility, not the employees who might, God forbid, be predators. And we're not trying to identify anyone who might already be in the system at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, I absolutely understand your comment. As we have contemplated what steps we need to take immediately in the Youth Authority to enhance youth safety, we have put a number of things in place that address the environments both in our facilities and our field to enhance both the supervision of staff, the accountability of casework, as well as we will talk later with the Office of Professional Standards, increased training and reporting of any kind of flag or indicator that a staff is acting outside of the parameters of either their professionalism and ethics and or their position description. I believe that there would be some problem in adding a new element to existing staff and say we're going to go through and now use this to determine whether we're going to keep you or not. It is performance-based. We look at their performance. We provide good supervision. We provide that documentation. And that's the process that we currently have in place.
Just a comment, it seems like that's very similar to doing initial drug testing on new hires, but then never following up.
You can comment on that if you want to, or you can move on.
Sure. Again, Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsitt, we as well do initial drug screening, as I believe you're aware, and then if there's any performance indicator that an individual is using drugs, we have the ability to go in and do another drug screen, but we do not randomly test them. Looking at the mandatory abuse training, pre-service training for staff and foster parents, again on the training page top. We have implemented curriculum for the training of foster parents, and all of our foster parents have been trained to that curriculum. We worked with the Morrison Center under contract, who runs Parker Care, and they helped us develop that curriculum, and all of the foster parents have been trained. Currently, the certifiers are undergoing training as a group. Sex offenders and their grooming of victims and others, we have a contract in place with a community provider, Corey Jewell, who actually has done this specific targeted training around sex offenders grooming of adults, and she has developed curriculum that has been used both in school-based training and other community organizations, and she will be training our staff and working out the curriculum that will be implemented. But that contract is also in place. The mandatory abuse reporting training, the recommendation from the safety committee was that we revisit that with our staff, make certain that everyone understood what their legal responsibilities were, what mandatory abuse was, what the reporting requirements were, and that was completed for the 1,000 youth authority staff within the first 90 days. And so when we came before you a year ago, that was completed. Pre-service training for JPPO, we talked about that. That's a four-week curriculum. Also, the recommendation was to limit this on-the-job training where you have a parole officer shadowing another parole officer and learning from them. There is a formalized curriculum. Then they go and begin their job responsibilities with the relationship with their supervisor. And we have moved away from the on-the-job training from another peer. In the area of policy, which will be on the next page, there was concern in the findings of the safety committee that Oregon Youth Authority policies and procedures were kind of all over the map. As we moved from DHS, we just did a word replacement on all the applicable employment policies, foster care policies, supervision policies, replacing DHS, CSD, with OIA. We had begun a process already of going through and rewriting and updating those policies and procedures. What we have done and was a recommendation is that the policies be proactive, and the policies actually start with a statement of what it is the youth authority wants this policy to do, what is the outcome of this policy intended to do, and then the policy works from that. We've also coupled it with training. So with every policy that comes out, there also is a training curriculum. We introduce the policy and we train our staff to those policies at the same time. The revision again of the policies and procedures is probably 80% completed in the agency on the policy and rule side, and procedures are currently being written. The external review committee recommended that we have an outside source review all of our policies and procedures. We did. We contracted with an outside entity, Juvenile Corrections Council of Corrections Administrators. They reviewed every one of our policies and procedures and came up with a document of recommendation, and that document has been implemented. So we are following their recommendations. Develop and revise specific policies and procedures. One was the professional relationships and boundaries. And this was one that we spent a fair amount of time as an agency. And we have developed both a policy for principles of conduct for our staff. We have developed a training curriculum that is now DVD-based. Our staff are taking that training. We have posters that are placed in all of our work sites, and be happy to pass this around for folks to take a look at, along with a couple of other posters that are currently placed in work sites about reporting of abuse for youth in a couple of different formats. So this has all been part of this campaign from the Youth Authority to make certain that staff fully understand the expectation for both the principles of conduct, have had the training, and it is up there to remind them in all the work areas, including administration. The duty to report suspected misconduct and abuse, again, that was part of the mandatory abuse training that was completed right away.
There was concern on the part of the review committee that staff had the ability to limit access of parents to youth that were in our physical custody, and that that was perhaps a formula for disaster. And we have taken great steps to mitigate the ability of any one individual to say that a set of parents or family cannot visit an offender that is in our physical custody or in the custody of a community-based provider. A couple of things, again, the risk-need assessment drives the case plan, the quality assurance over that plan, which would include, you know, parental family reunification contact. That is done by a multidisciplinary team. Individually, people don't make those decisions unless it is a one-time thing for safety or security reasons. We have done training to implement that particular policy. We have done outreach to parents. We are doing a parental survey that will be ongoing to parents that have youth in our custody. It's a quality assurance survey. It's a blind survey. Comes back into our Office of Professional Standards, reviewed there, and that information will then be quantified, and we will look for a kind of trend analysis, as well as the individual has the ability to put their name and request contact by that office. We are also doing an introduction letter revising that as part of our intake process, which families will get, kind of talking about their rights and responsibilities, you know, what the code of conduct for the agency is. We currently have that out for outside review. I saw Dr. Judith here. He is one that is going to be reviewing that. I think he currently has that in his shop to take a look at for us. The next area is the recommendations on how we handle complaints. And the first recommendation was that we establish an Office of Internal Investigations. And when the Youth Authority was originally funded and throughout its course of existence, we have not had this particular function within the Youth Authority. It's been a personnel function based on a personnel investigation, or it has been a supervisory function. We were funded, as you may recall, from the Emergency Board for an internal investigator, and I'm going to have Jason do the last page himself, who is the individual that was hired to set up that office and manage it for us. We have, at the recommendation of the committee, safety committee, we have contacted every youth that was on Mr. Boyle's caseload. That process was done by the Department of Justice. We made phone contact and or letter contact for those that could not be found by phone, soliciting any kind of input or response to the possibility that anyone else who had not yet come forward might have been abused by this individual. We did not net anything from that, but everyone who was available was contacted. And we went back to when Mr. Burrows was a child welfare caseworker. So there were scores of youth that were contacted. Conduct exit interviews with youth, another recommendation that was made. We have developed a survey instrument that not only goes to parents, but one that goes to youth, and that is also a blind survey. They can either identify themselves and request follow-up or not. We were recommended to develop a memorandum of understanding with the Oregon State Police to do our investigations for any kind of suspected abuse or misconduct in facilities. That's been our practice and protocol, but we did not have one standing memorandum of understanding with the Oregon State Police. That is also now in place. We do have that. And then on the miscellaneous recommendations, create an open organization. And this was a challenging undertaking. We started off doing a couple of things. The first was to develop the principles of conduct and be very clear with our staff with what our expectations were for their conduct, as well as administration and management. The second was to
involve the agency in a formalized strategic planning process, brought in an outside individual to lead that effort, and all of our staff and stakeholders and advisory committee members participated in that process and had the opportunity for input into what the strategic plan for the agency should be. We have implemented a number of survey instruments, both for youth and for their families, as well as gone out. Deputy Director Lemon and myself have spent the summer and fall traveling the state. We've been to each of our parole and probation offices, each of our facilities. We've met with residential providers. We've met with organized labor, which we do on an ongoing basis. But we have talked about the fact that communication is really a two-way street, and making certain that people understand that not only do they have access to the highest levels of the organization, but that is encouraged for them to use that email, in person, however phone call they want to do that. In one of the meetings we had, one of our staff made the comment, well, I bet you'll be really glad when this is behind you and you can move on. And I said, well, actually, to the contrary, because this never is going to be behind youth authority. This is going to become part of the culture and part of this organization. And although the changes that we have made have at times been painful, and the introspection and the look from outside at times has been painful, very necessary, and I think that the results that it has accomplished are very notable in regards to the changes that we have talked about. Standard process for incident response, again, Jason will talk about that from the Office of Professional Standards. There was comment made about the access to records by outside review committees. You bring a group of folks together, say, hey, help us look at this case, help us look at what went wrong, and then we say, well, we really can't give the information that would make looking at that, you know, more productive and more thorough and more complete. We want to be a transparent agency. We have worked with Department of Justice to provide that access where that is currently appropriate and legal. We have also referred to the Juvenile Code Revision Work Group areas that we think would require substantive law change to open up records that are not would not currently be made available. And on the community resource team recommendation, this is for difficult to place youth. And as you recall, one of the issues we had in the Broyles case was that Mr. Broyles worked with very difficult to place youth and created some very marginal placement resources for these youth to go because they were hard to place. And each of our parole offices and each of our counties has a process in place to review difficult youth, but it ultimately rests with the youth authority to find that placement there in our custody. We have created a statewide resource committee and attached some resources to that so that if there is a difficult youth, local process does not produce an appropriate placement, then it rises a level of review at the central level where we have attached additional resources, as mentioned, to facilitate appropriate placement. So if there aren't questions on that piece, I'd like to introduce Jason Barber and have him talk a little bit about the creation of the Office of Professional Standards, what his role with the Oregon Youth Authority is, and where we're at with that.
Jason? Not putting any pressure on you, Jason. We're kind of on a timeline here today.
Chair Olson, committee members, my name is Jason Barber. I'm the Professional Standards Analyst for the Oregon Youth Authority. Prior to being hired in late July, I spent the last 9 years as the Assistant Director of the Crime Victims Assistance Section with DOJ and worked with many of you on projects such as address confidentiality, restitution reform. Prior to that, my investigatory background consists with work with the Department of Revenue, Safe Corporation, and the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And just wanted to go over some accomplishments. We've implemented a work group for professional standards consisting of internal affairs officers from Hillsborough PD, State Police, Department of Corrections and retired chief counsel for the Criminal Justice Division, as well as applicable OIA employees. The mission of that work group is to review policies, procedures, forms, and offer strategies and suggestions for the Professional Standards Office. We've been involved in some policy management, drafting PSO policy, outlining the authority, duties, responsibilities, the complaint process. We've worked on enhancing the complaint process within OIA. We have a 1-800 OIA complaint hotline up and running. Those calls come directly to my office. We've developed an electronic complaint form on our webpage. We've developed a PSO email. Mr. Jester referenced the surveys that are being administered throughout OIA. There's three different surveys. I think a total of 361 of those have come back from youth. Each one of those surveys has a safety component, and all of those get reviewed by the Professional Standards Office. With complaint tracking, all complaints against the agency or staff get funneled through the Professional Standards Office. We're using an interim case management system to track those right now. We're in the process of purchasing a new case management system that's very robust and one of the systems that's kind of the model in the U.S. right now for IA agencies. One key feature of that will be an early warning intervention. So if you have a staff member that meets a agency-defined threshold, say three complaints in a quarter, this system will automatically alert the PSO, employee services, or identified management staff of that fact, and remediation can take place. We are tracking all complaints. The minor complaints get referred out to a variety of different areas within OIA. Professional Standards really keeps and investigates those inappropriate behavior with youth and boundary issues. Every complaint is acknowledged, it's tracked, it's assigned follow-through right now, and resolved with a final disposition, including a status letter sent back to the complaint if applicable. Training and education, we've been implemented in the new employee orientation training regarding boundaries and ethics. We're developing a new PSO webpage, which will reference employee expectations, how to report complaints, ethics, self-checks, custodial misconduct, PREA, and administrative investigations. We're soon to start publishing an OIA ethics bulletin that will go out to employees quarterly just to provide some insight into misconduct cases that could result in termination of employment with OIA. And that's about all I have. Thank you.
Any questions? All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, we have Klamath County evidence-based practice, Steve Berger. Now, you really should have brought your sidekick, Commissioner Schweitzer, who was at the conference with you last week.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Steve Berger, Director of Community Corrections for Klamath and Lake County. As Senator Burdick mentioned previously on this presentation, I have the assistance of my liaison, Commissioner Schweitzer. Today with me is our actual team who put this program together that we'll be presenting. Sitting right next to me is Rod Clark, the CEO of CADA and Consortium, the treatment provider who manages the program that we'll be highlighting. Next to him is Rich Rose, and on the very end there is Steve Haugy, both CADA consortium employees who will be assisting with the presentation and then also available if there's additional questions specific to the program. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Rod to provide a brief introduction and context to the presentation.
Good morning. Good morning, Co-Chairs Burke and Olson, committee members. I'd like to thank Senator Witzer for arranging some time on your agenda. He's been a knowledgeable and true supporter of treatment in Klamath County.
Identify yourself.
Yes, I'm Rod Clark. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of Klamath Alcohol and Drug Abuse. I also served as the president of the Statewide Directors Association for several years. We have some interesting information to present to you. Last session, there was some legislation passed, called for best practices in arenas of treatment and corrections. We were actually pleased because we've been engaging in best practices for more than a decade, and we're pleased to see that the idea of using best practices was being recognized on a legislative level. Because we're Klamath County small, we all know each other. We actually work in cooperation. It's not lip service. There is virtually no stigma to alcohol, drug and alcohol treatment in Klamath County. It's actually valued and appreciated. That's what I'm sure you're hearing Commissioner Schweitzer say, notwithstanding his conservative credentials. The program we're presenting today is about the financial impact of a single program in Klamath County. You're going to hear a lot of testimony during this session about best practices from a variety of providers. I will remind you that part of the purpose of best practices was to assure financial impact of employing best practices on the state of Oregon and the taxpayers of the state of Oregon. And I believe we're going to have some data that is going to be an eye-opener, and the data is in progress, but it is very conservative, it's very reliable, and it's fairly astounding. And with that, I'd like to turn it back over to Steve Berger.
Thank you. Even before Senate Bill 267, we received a challenge from our local Board of County Commissioners to seek new opportunities to integrate proven strategies in our well-established continuum community services. To provide some brief context leading up to this initiative, I think it's important to identify what is likely the most important aspect of the partnership in community corrections between the county and the state that was established by Senate Bill 1145. This opportunity provided local control and the ability to use locally based solutions with offenders. In Klamath, this partnership is carried out in a facility constructed with joint resources. Following the community corrections transition from state to county, Klamath County initiated the planning process for a community corrections center. What we designed was a facility incorporating three primary components of community corrections: supervision, sanctions, and services. This was essentially a partnership, again, with joint resources between the state and county. In 2003, we opened the one-stop-style community corrections center and entered into collaborative partnerships with local treatment providers to co-locate and co-manage the offender population. Based upon research and evidence-based practice principles, we believe co-location and service integration of community corrections and counseling agencies enhance offender participation, successful completion of counseling, and probation and parole supervision. In practice, we found co-location and co-case management removes some simple hurdles often encountered within the criminal justice system, such as communication and the division of responsibilities, often referred to as a siloed approach. When the primary partners involved in managing an offender reside in the same facility, it encourages those partners to communicate in person rather than telephone, voicemail, email, or old-school letters and memos. Recognizing this was a new model for us, we initiated a review process to assist in assessing the effectiveness. The following information is from the first 2 years tracking new arrests, jail time, and employment status of 99 clients participating in the program. As a new program, the two-year mark was our first opportunity to compare pre- and post-behavior and determine if there was an associated cost effect. We found new criminal arrests dropped 85% in comparing participating clients, the 99, from 1 year before treatment and supervision to 1 year after. I want to note this was in relation to all clients, not just those that were successful, and this review documented all arrests, sanctions, probation violations, not just those that were resulting in a new conviction. 96% decrease in arrests by the clients that were successful in treatment. And additionally, we saw a 66% of the unsuccessful clients committed no new offenses 1 year after treatment. I point this out to demonstrate a positive effect that was realized even from those who were technically unsuccessful in the relationship. Reduced unemployment 31 percentage points of all clients from 45% unemployment to 14% following the program. Clients that successfully completed treatment resulted in a 73% reduction of days in jail from the year prior to the year following. And of the 44 clients that successfully completed treatment, only two went back to jail after treatment for committing a new criminal offense. Lastly, the other part of Senate Bill 267 talks about cost effectiveness. We found nearly a $1 million net savings for the taxpayers in arrests, jail, and victimization costs in comparing the year prior to treatment to the year after the treatment. Substantiating the highlighted outcomes, we will provide an overview of the process, demographics of the clients, defined treatment status, and the effect of the new arrests, jail, and costs. Today you've heard the phrase best practices, and the way we define that is simply practices that have proven to yield positive outcomes to correctional clients. We have also used this review process as a starting point for continuing research and future demonstration projects. Senator Whitsitt was very helpful in a project with us locally in establishing a program that will be enhancing this, moving it into a residential-style program through a justice assistant grants that will allow us to start a program, a residential component in Klamath. How this works? We started by removing the traditional barriers outlining the responsibilities and duties for each discipline. Integrating community corrections and treatment services, we brought the two disciplines together by co-managing the clients, using jointly developed case plans based on criminogenic risk and need assessments, and incorporating cognitive behavioral counseling such as and motivational interviewing with traditional tools such as urine testing and short jail sanctions when necessary. Steve, would you like to comment a little bit about that co-management and the risk assessment component?
I'm Steve Haughey. I'm the program manager for the consortium, Klamath Alcohol and Drug Abuse Program. How we're looking at, we work very closely with the Department of Corrections, and we have a probation officer that's part of our therapeutic team. Traditionally, there's been separation between treatment and probation, and we combine that. And what we're looking at for this population is we're looking at arrests and jail sanctions, short-term jail sanctions, as enhancing motivation and interrupting a behavior that's detrimental towards recovery. So we're looking at that as a very positive step in a therapeutic process of the treatment program.
Steve Berger back again. As noted earlier, we found co-location with community treatment providers greatly enhanced communications and fostered positive working relationships between the officers and the counselors. These relationships are what we believe form the foundation for us to manage the offender population in developing case plans and treatment plans. Steve, do you want to add any additional comments relative to the evidence-based practice component of that?
Well, there's a variety of evidence-based practices we use in treatment, but really it starts with something that's really not from a manual, but it's a practice that works very effectively, and it's really co-case management, and it's combining treatment and corrections. And we're in on the corrections point of view, we're looking at a criminogenic needs assessment, and a referral to a specific level of care. We have a continuum of care in Klamath County that really targets specific difficult populations, specifically the population we deal with. We use the best practice, and one of the initial ones is ASAM. The ASAM assessment combined with criminogenic needs allows us to target specific populations that have specific needs, and it's proven to be very effective and us participating in that continuum of care.
Thanks. Now, before we go to the next slides, which are a little more dry and detail-oriented, I would like to briefly describe the client demographics within this program. These are clients who have been unsuccessful in several previous programs, and upon initial review, are those generally viewed as least likely to succeed. These are not the cream puff clients generally who you review to make your program look good. And all clients within this program were either scored as high or medium risk to reoffend. To look at this data comparing 1 year prior to 1 year after, we used a study by Carrie Finnegan in 2003 who identified an average arrest and booking cost of just a little over $2,100. And we determined the 99 offenders in the program accounted for 166 arrests for a total cost of $350,000 in the year prior to treatment and supervision. As you look down below on that screen, you can see the contrast with the same clients, successful or not, accounted for 25 arrests or $53,000. That basically accounts for a savings of just under $300,000. I want to point out the use of jail time. As you look at that screen there, it shows that there's a small bar in the middle between the two that indicates there was jail time during the course of treatment. While it may be an unusual concept for some, we found it to be an integral part of our treatment process. Steve, you might be maybe better suited to speak about how we integrate jail in treatment.
Well, again, in looking at combining the disciplines, we're using clear communication with the Department of Corrections employees and treatment and triangulation and to be an effective voice in promoting positive change with the client. Jail tends to help bring the reality up to the client and kind of contrast that with progress they can make in treatment. So we find it to be very effective.
Thank you. I also want to note, as you look at the bar graph for 1 year after, where you see the red bar graph of unsuccessful noting 2,086 days, 1 year following treatment, six of the 55 unsuccessful clients accounted for just a little over 1,600 of those days. Or another way to represent that might be to say 11% can't represent 11% of that unsuccessful population represents 77% of the jail days used. So, as often is the case with perceptions, it's generally what we experienced was it's a small population that drives some of those costs. But again, in general, we saw a dramatic decrease in those costs. This slide simply accounts for the cost of jail days at an average state rate of $78.26 per day. Moving on to the cost of supervision, if we're going to compare the post behavior to the preceding year, we must account for the cost of the supervision and treatment. Using the Carey and Finnegan study and data provided by the Oregon Department of Corrections, we're able to determine the cost of the program incorporating supervision and treatment. You can see there under supervision, the cost of high-risk supervision, based on last biennium's accounting, was a little over $11 a day. Medium risk, $6 a day. And then again, using that average state jail cost. And then down below, we have the Carey and Finnegan number accounting for the average cost of treatment per client. Totaling the supervision costs associated to high and medium risk offenders and the treatment costs, we find that equaling just a little over $421,000. The next chart walks us through the fiscal impacts of the client arrest, booking, court time, jail cost, and victimization. I'm introducing victimization cost at this time based upon a Department of Justice study completed in 1996. The Department of Justice identified victimization costs to include factors such as loss of productivity from work, mental health counseling, and property loss damage and quality of life. The associated cost was found to be a little over $6,600 per offense. Although it's important to note this is a conservative amount, recognizing most offenders often account for several victims per arrest, we only used one victimization cost per arrest. Including victimization costs, we identified, as you can follow through there, the costs of arrest, jail costs, and then including the victimization, a little over $1.8 million impact for 1 year prior to supervision and treatment. Below that solid green line there on the comparison, you can see post-supervision and treatment, there was an associated cost of $418,000.
I just want to get back. Maybe I missed this during your presentation, but I'm curious, Steve. You're talking about the victimization cost and showing it as $6,675 per offense. Is that specifically felonies?
In this program, it was specifically felony-oriented. I would have to go back to the research from the Kerry and Finnegan. To the Kerry Finnegan study on if that was specific to felony or misdemeanor, but if I remember correctly, I don't think they broke that out between felony and misdemeanor. I don't believe.
Thank you.
But again, in this study, these were all felony offenders.
Okay.
So for a net savings comparison, we start with the difference between the year prior and the year following, and we subtract the cost of the supervision and supervision sanctions and treatment. So from that $1.3 million, we subtract $421,000, and essentially we have the better part of $1 million in savings. This was a simple example of a small program in Klamath County where 99 clients benefited from a cost-effective collaborative relationship based on evidence-based practices and principles. We found ways to integrate these principles in the rural community, and essentially we're here as an encouragement to other communities and statewide to take a look at how they do things, maybe look at alternatives to some of those siloed approach, create new partnerships, and I think we can all achieve what is often it doesn't get the same level of attention as the first part of 267, which talks about evidence-based practices. The other side of 267 also talks about it needs to be cost-effective, and we need to be able to show the taxpayers that we're using their money prudently and saving them money.
To summarize and drive a few points home, having introduced it. One, this was a $60,000 a year contract between the Department of Corrections and one of my programs. It's just been documented at a very conservative level using scientifically valid criteria that it saved our community just short of $1 million. Two things you can draw from this are, one, a variety of best practices is the most effective way to deal with clients. And one of those best practices is to co-case manage with clients. My counselors incorporate the PO's requirements into the treatment planning. The treatment planning is incorporated into the PO's requirements. So there's no triangulation. There's no pointing the finger and blaming one another and avoiding accountability. It's a really a critical factor. Co-location is also important. I also would like to advise you that this was an incomplete study in that it did not include the cost of public defenders or district attorneys. So our district attorney's office has now produced financial data on the cost savings to their office, which we have not yet incorporated. We want to make sure it's conservative and reliable. The public defenders are doing the same. Our hospital is doing the same. Our HMO is doing the same. Our local children's service division is doing the same. And the welfare office is doing the same. This is a ripple effect to all this. That $60,000, in my opinion, saved in excess of $2 million of taxpayer funds. I think that's a best practice, and it's something to be somewhat proud of. We will be completing a thorough analysis, and we'll be coming back, and we are going to have an academically published study that will be entitled The Economic Impact of Treatment in Klamath County, and it will include our partnerships and the way we do business. I would add just one point. This is not the only program we're doing in Klamath County that exercises these principles. We co-case management with welfare workers. Klamath County has the highest percentage of reduction in welfare load in the state of Oregon. The reward that DHS gave Klamath County for that was the funding that permitted those practices to take place was eliminated. And so you might want to look at policies to try to encourage these kinds of innovations and impacts. And I thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Whitsitt, did you have anything to add to this?
A couple things. Thank you, Chair Burdick. Stephen, in your unemployment reduction, I think we commented on this before, but the actual reduction was 31%, but the change in the unemployment rate is 300%, from 42 to 14%, from 42 to 14. So the actual change is 300% reduction in unemployment. I think that one thing that you haven't brought out is that to the extent that the successful clients remain crime-free, these are cumulative figures. I would assume that the 99 people who go in your program, if they pretty much remain crime-free and you treat another 99, year over year, that becomes cumulative. And it becomes a safer community and a great deal less expensive. And then just the third thing is a comment. Kind of breaks down between actual work time and elapsed time, and what you folks are doing is the work time involves investigation, the evaluation, the decision, and the sanction. You're all in the same building, you get it all done maybe in 1, 2, 3 days, and the parole officer goes out, takes it up, Judge Rambo drops his cattle, puts him in prison for a couple of days, or a week or whatever. For immediate sanction, whereas the elapsed time in many situations like this, by the time you pass papers back and forth, you return phone calls and so forth, the elapsed time might be 2 or 3 months. And I think that's specifically what makes this program, as Mark pointed out, so successful. It is it flows quickly and smoothly, and people understand very soon that if they don't comply, there is a sanction that's almost immediate.
Thank you very much. This is the second time in a little over a week I've had a chance to see this presentation. I just can't tell you how impressed I continue to be. I think for the members of the committee, Representative Olson was there at the conference last week in Portland, but for the rest of the committee, Commissioner Schweitzer at the conference made the point that Klamath County is a very conservative county. It's not necessarily the place where you would see alternatives to incarceration really take hold. And when you pointed out the key element of evidence-based practices is, and this is really why the bill was adopted in the first place, it was during a budget crunch. Mm-hmm. We've got to do things smarter, folks. And I just really commend you for the work you've done, and I encourage you to keep going to try to get a drug court established, because these principles are the same principles that a drug court has.
Madam Chairman, we have a drug court.
I thought, did you have one that just started? Because I was...
We're just starting a youth drug court. We've had an adult drug court for 10 years, which would be an interest to report someday on the outcomes we've achieved through that.
Well, I'm glad you reminded me of that. I was confused because we had a funding request before us, which led me to believe you didn't have
it. We were doing it without any funding.
I'm very glad you have it, and I'm sure you're using the same principles with the same results in that. So thank you very much, and thank you, Senator Whitsitt, for getting them on the agenda.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next on the agenda, Senator Bessie Johnson. Yeah, so Representative Sal Esquivel is not here.
He is not joining me. I'm flying solo today.
Representing Fort Clatsop, I assume.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're here. Okay, all right, we'll watch this.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I'm the state senator from District 16, but today I am here representing both Representative Esquivel and myself as co-chairs of an interim committee on the real estate agency, oversight of the real estate agency. And my purpose for appearing today is to ask this committee to be the vehicle by which some legislative concepts are introduced into the process. This became the committee that whose time schedule met most closely with the drafting requirements of legislative council. I also would like to recognize Representative Ackerman, and I'm going to ask him to help me if I stray too far from the path. He served as one of the members of the task force. The genesis of the committee was out of the 2005 session. Concerns were raised about the operation and organizational structure of the real estate agency. Legislators received testimony and information indicating that the real estate agency appeared to be inconsistent in the application of a number of administrative actions concerning regulation of the industry. And so at the request of the Oregon Association of Realtors, House Bill 2604 was enacted, taking effect January 1, 2006. This bill consolidated and modified grounds for discipline of real estate licensees and directed the real estate commissioner to adopt rules regarding investigation of complaints, client trust accounts, and progressive discipline. Responding to the passage of this bill, Governor Kulongowski directed DAS to assemble an interagency performance review team and report on the workings of the Oregon Real Estate Agency and the audit that was dated July the 21st, and I believe that you have copies of it provided in your materials, identified a number of key issues and offered some recommendations. During the budget hearings, a budget note was included in House Bill 5137, directing legislative leadership to appoint a work group, and that's the work group that I've mentioned Representative Ackerman served on, to consider the agency's budget and to specifically review the following issues: the role and function and composition of the real estate board, the role and practices of the real estate commissioner in the agency, alternative forms of licensure and regulation of the industry, and the internal audit that I have previously mentioned. And so the task force was assembled. It was chaired by myself and Representative Esquivel. The members were Senators Frank Shield, Bruce Starr, Representatives Ackerman, Kim Thatcher, Greg Smith, and Larry Galizio. Outside members were Scott Taylor, the commissioner, and public members Art Kegler, Vada Salinas, and Brad Vincent. And we met a number of times in a number of locations and brought forward a suite of proposals that we're hoping to have introduced as legislation that would be consistent with the task force recommendations. Specifically, what we want to do is to move the role and authority of the real estate board from advisory to policy making. And I can go into as much detail as you would like or respond to specific questions, or I can do this at a very high level. It's the chair's prerogative to tell me how you'd like me to proceed. I'd be happy to stay at a pretty high level if that would...
That'd be fine.
Okay. Well, our first recommendation, and the most substantive, is the one that I just said, and that's to change the role and authority from advisory to policy making. Secondly, we want to make sure that the commissioner is fully accountable to the board. There had been almost a complete disconnect between the activities of the board with respect to good governance and the commissioner, and we're changing the model now to have this board be very engaged in the oversight of the agency and in their interactions with the commissioner, and the commissioner are fully accountable to this board. And finally, the board and the agency will be tasked with reviewing and analyzing ancillary regulatory tasks of the agency. We heard a fair amount of testimony concerning what responsibilities the agency carried out, how efficiently they were carried out, were there other places where the work could be done, for example, agency review of condominium plans, could this work be more appropriately done in another agency? agency. So we've left open the door for the exploration of efficiencies within the real estate agency by having work put in different places. And so that really is the sum total of the legislative concepts. Again, I'd be happy to respond to questions or invite correction or criticism from Representative Ackerman, who sat through all of these meetings, and I'd be happy to entertain your questions. The specific request of you today is to introduce, as committee bills, the suite of legislative concepts that we would like to have reflect these recommendations from the task force.
Members?
I will accept the senator's invitation. This was a very dynamic task force, and the co-chairs and the staff deserve great compliments for basically going through a complete overhaul of this agency. And I don't mean overhaul in a negative manner, because as we found, this real estate agency was operating under state statutes, which I think were not modern, outdated, archaic, invested almost complete authority in the real estate commissioner and left the board in even less than an advisory role. The most dynamic thing that occurred, I think, was our conclusion that the board should have policymaking authority. The other dramatic, I think, reaction to this was the fact that the real estate community and existing board members, most of whom were real estate professionals, wanted this responsibility. And they came forth not only in the hearings, but in other ways to demonstrate that they wanted policymaking authority over the real estate agency, and I think that's a positive proposal. So I think that overall, and perhaps without exception, the recommendations here are really a product of great leadership from our co-chairs, great staff work, and represent a fine example of good government, and I hope they will find their way into legislation in the next session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your good work on this, and I can assure you that your bills will be introduced and they will get consideration during the session.
Excellent. Thank you very much, Madam Chair. The one other piece of information just to complete the panel's knowledge of the situation at the agency right now is the fact that since the task force completed their work, Scott Taylor, the acting commissioner, has indicated that he is going to be stepping down, retiring. And so we're very hopeful that a newly energized board will be very engaged in making recommendations to the governor for a new appointment. It is my observation, having sat through many, many meetings on this agency, that the agency has some repair work to do with the community that it serves. There are some kind of frayed relationships, and I am hopeful that the new commissioner will make his or her number one priority beginning to reestablish the relationship between the regulatory agency and the community that it serves. So with that, Madam Chair, and your assurance that the legislative concepts will move forward out of this committee, I have nothing else to bring before the panel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, our next item is the report of the dependency work group, and I understand Mr. Taylor is going to be doing those duties today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and in lieu of Chair Krieger's absence, who was on the
I'm still not of the male gender, Mr. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I stand corrected again. Mea culpa. In lieu of Representative Krieger making this report, I am. Way back at the start of last interim, Joe O'Leary would be members of the committee with Representative Krieger and other members, and DHS formed what is called a sensitive review committee to look at a particular case before there was in the dependency system involving children and families in the court system. At the same time, this particular case was winding its way through the judicial process in the Court of Appeals. After completing their review, they formed a work group consisting of Representative Krieger, Representative Schaffler, Senator Brown, and Senator Cruz. The model for this was the meth task force work group of last session. You have before you the 10 concepts that are being considered. These are still a work in progress, so they are not public yet. There'll be two more meetings, at least two more meetings of this work group, one next week to meet with judges and one the week after, 2 weeks after, to meet with the department. Also behind, I have enclosed a study from the Washington State Pilot Project Evaluation. One of the things that has come out during this whole process, and if I can probably encapsulate it by giving you an example, in the sensitive review case, one thing that came out is the state agency, through the Department of Justice, spent $130,000 in legal fees. The family was allocated approximately $6,000. One of the things they uncovered was that the representation in the circuit court was less than adequate. The representation of the Court of Appeals was very good because the case was overturned and sent back to the circuit court. One of the things this study from Washington State shows that if you have adequate representation, what they did up there is they created a pilot project. They reduced the number of cases dependency lawyers were handling. They gave them additional resources, including additional funds. And if you see at the very back here, what the results were. The results were, and they evaluated this pilot project at the same time. There was significant reduction in time that the child spent in foster care and a substantial increase in the number of kids that reunited with their families. This is the crux of what the work group is looking at. This is a series of issues that it's considering, and it will be filing legislation sometime probably in January.
Okay, well, we really look forward to the work product of this group. I've been following it along the sidelines, and it looks like some good things are going to come out of this. Thank you for your report. Are there questions from the committee? Mr. Taylor? Okay, now our next item is going to be a little bit in mystery territory. It's on the bill introduction. We will not be doing it the same way we have in the past when we've operated as a joint committee, because we are now two separate committees that meet jointly. So, Mr. Taylor, you are going to have to guide us through on this. I presume that you would like to present the drafts to the joint committee, and then we can break apart and introduce the ones on either side. Is that correct?
That's correct, Madam Chair, members of the committee. You have two lists before you. One from the House, one from the Senate. What I would like to tell you is that neither Patsy Ward nor I get a bonus for the numbers of bills introduced, but between the two committees combined, we're over 160 bills. Plus, there will be additional bills filed by the Court Administrator's Office, the Urban Law Commission.
Okay, Ms. Taylor, let me interrupt you for a second. I'm going to go ahead and open a work session now for us to proceed on this. So we close the public hearing, open a work session for bill introduction. Okay, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Many of the...
Both?
Yes.
House needs to open up a work session.
Okay.
Yeah. House opens up a work session. Let's see. Also, you're going to go ahead then, Patsy, and call the two representatives.
Patsy, can you leave that for quorum until Senator Barr comes back?
I think he'll be back in time for the vote.
Okay.
But I need one more House member. Okay. So I'm going to try and get Representative Cameron in.
Committee will be at ease while this is going on here.
Your side. Is that
Senator Cameron, it's the Judiciary Committee calling.
Hello. Good morning.
Hello. I'm trying to get you over to the desk. And you just opened up the work session on the phone.
Okay.
Welcome, Representative Cameron. I hope you have some time. We've got a lot of bills to go over.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us. Are you someplace fun?
Yeah.
All right. Mr. Taylor, are we going to, Patsy, did you try anyone else? Or
the only other one is Representative Wisnett was available by cell phone, but you've got the quorum.
Yeah, we have our quorum.
Okay. We got our quorum. We're happy campers.
No,
pardon?
Senator Prezanski just stepped off a second.
We don't need a quorum till we vote.
Okay.
So, Mr. Taylor, why don't you proceed?
Chairman of the Committee, you have the two lists before you. On many of these bills are bills that we've looked to for my people that are usually before us, the Oregon State Bar. They're here, and I'm sure would like to make a brief presentation concerning their bills. Kingsley Cliff is here from the State Court Administrator's Office. There's a separate list of the bills that they have had drafted and traditionally come before us. These are usually the bills that we look to early in session. In addition to that, we have bills in here that have come in from work groups of various members have been involved in. They are before us, and we have bills that, as I said, come in from people who normally have bills before the Judiciary Committee. But we also have the Oregon Law Commission here.
Representative Cameron?
Yes.
What on earth are you doing?
What am I doing?
I want to mute that.
I don't know how to put this thing on mute so you don't pick up background noise, I guess.
I think so.
Turn off the show.
There was water at a faucet for a coffee pot. That's what it was.
Oh.
Hey, if that happens again, you're going to be doing push-ups.
Thank you. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Taylor.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be glad to, as much as possible, answer any questions on the various drafts. I've read most of them, but I have to admit some just came in the last 12 hours, 24 hours.
Let me ask a process question here. I have in my notebook the proposed legislation of Senate Judiciary, and Representative Olson has the House. So the things in my notebook from the Law Commission and the State Bar, they're not notated as Senate, but these are all Senate drafts. Is that correct in my notebook? And he has different ones in his notebook.
I'm sure members of the committee, I'd have to...
They're highlighted on their individual sheets, which of their bills they want introduced in the House and which in the Senate.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I take it that you both have the same list, except there's notations on those lists as to where the bills are proposed to go.
I see. Okay. I got it. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Now, so do you want to move into the Judicial Department and have them explain their drafts, or do you want to go ahead and...
Madam Chair, I think it would be best if Kingsley Click. I know she's been sitting here all morning waiting to...
I thought she was just fascinated by the subject matter of my meeting today.
I believe the Oregon State Bar would like to make a brief comment. I had just received some written material from them, so I'm sure they'd like to come up too.
Okay, why don't both of you
I can't speak for the Law Commission, but they are here, so.
Why don't we have all three entities come up, and then we'll just take them in order. Welcome. Why don't you start, Kingsley? Thank you.
For the record, I'm Kingsley Flick with State Court Administrator, and thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair and members of the committee for allowing us to come in pre-session file our judiciary-related bills through your respective committees. I was hoping that Bill Taylor actually would do his thing first so we could figure out what the process should be to best serve you. My thought is we, the Judicial Department, have 10 bills that we're asking to be pre-session filed, and then we're also co-sponsors on two others, and I'm not sure the... I think one of them goes through the State Bar. I'm not sure how the other one, that's a multi-one, gets introduced, but I'll mention it. Okay, thank you. For our 10, I can just read the LC number and our title, and then if there are any questions that you have, you could stop me and I could give a little bit more about what it's about. I did provide in our handout a couple of paragraphs on each of our LCs, so that gives you at least a shooting direction of what they're about. Under tax court administration procedures, we have two LCs we're asking to pre-session file. In the, these are both for the House. LC 672, that extends the deadline on tax appeal settlements. And then LC 673, that transfers certain reporting duties back to the Department of Revenue that really has the information.
Those are both in for the House?
For the House, please. And when the time comes, Judge Breithaupt will be coming to testify on them.
Right.
We have a, we'll call State Court Administration Court Procedures Bill for the House. It's LC 850. It's our administrative housekeeping bill. Most are aware we get from our trial courts what we call little technical glitches that they find in the statutes and say would streamline their processes if we could get them fixed. A lot of them, we have about eight of them, I believe, in this bill, and we believe that they're non-controversial, though of course they may need fine-tuning. Under collections, we have two LCs, both for the House, LC 772 and LC 826. These are to enhance the department's collection efforts, one to allow federal tax offsets for judicial department debts, and also allow the lottery to review if their outstanding debts before payout. The other LC, the 826, extends our license and suspension period from 5 to 10 years in order to conform with changes in the registration timeframes that DMV changed a couple of years back. In appellate procedure, we have two LCs we're requesting go through the Senate. LC 773, that provides a process for muni courts and justice of the peace courts to be designated as courts of records, which change where they file appeals. LC 774, that provides clarification on timely service and what happens with cases under, so going through settlement with workers' comp, even though they had to file a notice of appeal already. In the family law area, we're following some suggestions from legislative counsel to ask for specific statutory forms to be taken out of the statutes, which will free up more pages for new laws, and allow us to prescribe the format used to meet the statutory criteria. In the access to justice area, we have two...
Family law, the LC 847 is out
for
Senate.
And some remaining two are for Senate. We tried to evenly divide them. In the access to justice area, we have two for the Senate, LC 851, which would just conform with the federal ADA laws, some of our jury deliberation room assistance for jurors, and LC 852, which is part of a proposal from our work group on conforming statutory court fee waiver and deferral processes in the courts. It's both a response to litigation and to access issues. And then, as I mentioned earlier, I believe these are on then the judiciary and the state bars. Introduction LC 321 has to do with interest on criminal judgments, and LC 676, which has to do with electronic court document management.
And those are both Susan as well?
I believe Susan has an indication on those. I don't know which those are being requested for. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, why don't we move to Ms. Grady. Are you going to talk about 321 and 676 first, or should we just cross those off and put those on your list? Okay. Okay, go for it.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Susan Grady with the Oregon State Bar here today, and I just wanted to take a moment to go through this. And I would like to take a moment to invite our board member, Jerry Gatos from Eugene, who did show up today to say just a few words about DeBar's process. And then I'm happy to walk through the bills. We split our bills up half and half between the House and the Senate so that we would be able to appear in both chambers and simultaneously almost. And you have before you a list of our bills. There are 25 in total, and that's a number of them, and I can walk through them quickly or for the record if that's what we need to do today process-wise, or I can defer at this moment and let Mr. Gatos say
If Mr. Gatos wants to briefly describe the process, that's fine. We just want a very, very quick summary on the bill. Before you get started, I don't see LC 321 and LC 676 on your list, so
they
if you want them. What?
They are House bills, so they're on the House list.
Yeah, but I don't see them on the state bar exit list.
Madam Chair, Susan Gravy, for the record, LC 676 is on the list at the top.
Yeah, I see that now.
And actually, LC 321, I don't have, Kingsley.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 321 is on the House list, and it's listed under Paul Snyder because he's the person who originally requested the draft that they've been working on.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Okay, well, I'm just trying to keep these in kind of some kind of order for the motion. So 676 and 321 look like they're both House bills.
Would you like, Madam Chair, would you like me to read through the list as to how our bills are separated?
No, because I have that notated on your list. I was just missing that
okay.
one. So how do you want to proceed? Do you want Mr. Gatos to come? Okay, he's taking a pass. So
he's making a pass.
Very brief summary on the LCs, if you could.
I'm happy to make a very brief summary. The first four LCs, LCs 674, 675, 676, and 677, are governance issues for the bar, and they're technical in nature. The largest one is 676, which is a co-sponsored bill with judiciary relating to e-filing, and it just will allow the Chief Justice to make rules regarding substitution of electronic documents and allow for electronic document management in the future. The rest of the bills on our list are listed before you according to substantive area of practice, so our sections, whether it's the consumer law, debtor-creditor, elder law, estate planning, etc., on down. And Mr. Taylor noted that I did not need to go through them affirmatively. What I'd like to do is submit the list to you, and I'm happy to answer any of your questions if there's one you have questions about. I would point out that LC 681, LC 691, LC 681 relating to consumer law, the tax credit, 691 relating to family law, and LC 695 are bills that were here last session and did not make it through Chamber of Origin, and we're back again to before you to discuss those issues.
Would you give those three numbers again?
LC 681 is a consumer law bill, and relates to an exemption for an additional child tax credit.
Right.
And that is in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
LC 691, Senator Burdick, you will remember this one. This is the one from last time you requested that the bar's family law section look at the issue regarding court discretion and reinstatement of spousal support issues.
How could I forget?
Yes. Well, we worked on it. We've come back with a fix for it, we think. And LC 695 is a real estate issue that we put off the table last time because it got wrapped up in all the annexation and land use issues, and we are back again. We think it's a bill that merits consideration.
Thank you for noting those. Okay, anything else to add on? Anything? Any questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome. Pardon my cough.
Thank you, Chair Burdick and Chair Olson, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson from the Oregon Law Commission, for the record. I just want to thank you for inviting the Law Commission last month to speak before the interim committees, and so I provided a summary of all of our recommended legislation at that meeting, so unless you'd like me to talk about any specific ones, I was not planning to give you that summary again, but we're here today to request pre-session filing for, you have listed 9 bills, but we have a correction that we'd like to make. The first one that's listed, LC 1176, the work group has decided they really need to break that into 2 bills because of the relating clauses and things, and so we would like to pre-session file 1176-2 and 1176-3.
Both in the House?
Both in the House. Also, for clarification, when I spoke last month before this committee, we provided a summary of all of the Law Commission's projects, and so you'll see a big gap missing, the ethics project and the government bonding project. We have decided not to pre-session file those pieces. We're still working with the Law Commission and our work groups. Those are major overhauls, and so we're going to file those as committee bills during session.
And which one is that?
Those are ethics projects, bills, and bonding, so they're not on your list, okay. Although they would have been on your list at the November meeting. So just clarifying that for the record. And I failed to note that at that meeting, but the ethics project is chaired by the Attorney General, and Representative Berger and Senator Johnston participated in that project. And so I think we'll be before the legislature quite a bit this session with the ethics project, but we're not going to pre-session file those bills. Again, if you have any questions about any of the listed bills, I'd be happy to note those. Again, we have a number of juvenile bills, a civil procedure bill, a couple of automobile insurance bills, and a family law bill.
We look forward to keeping them up early in the session, as we always do with the Law Commission, and thank you again for your...
Thank you.
...and all your commissioners for their hard work. Mr. Taylor, did you want to go through the master list for the House and Senate?
Chair, if you'd like me to do so, sure.
Senator Pisanski.
I just want to protocol from hearing Mr. Taylor whether we need to actually read in the record each of them, or can they be adopted based on the paperwork we have in front of us.
I think what I'll do is read off the titles and ask for a motion for them to be introduced in block. Is that a good way to do it, Mr. Taylor, to read off the LCs for both Representative Olson and I, to read off the LC numbers and then request a motion to introduce those in block?
Okay, sure.
Is that...
Madam Chairman, I've seen it done all different ways. That's appropriate.
We just want to be on the up and up here. Okay. Do you have anything to say about the LCs in front of us? Mr. Taylor.
Madam Chair, if you'd like me to go through them individually, I can. Collectively, I really don't have that much to say. I mean, these go all the way from work groups to individuals to our people like the Oregon State Bar. They run the gamut. Traditionally, and I know you both plan to make a statement, traditionally this is more to accommodate the system than a statement of support.
Okay. All right. Are there any committee members who would like any elaboration on any of these bills before us?
Madam Chair.
Right, Mr. Pisanski.
My understanding is, Mr. Taylor says, all we're doing today is basically introducing for whoever, whenever, however, these various LCs with no commitment as to what it is. And so it seems like it'd be just basically put it on the record and let's do it.
That is correct. That is our. We are here to serve the House and Senate Judiciary Committees, and we introduce bills as a committee without making a statement as to whether they're even going to be heard or what is going to happen to them. But they will be in the process by virtue of this introduction. So I'm just going to go ahead and take the plum from the Senate side now. Listen carefully, that's Senator Wilson. Okay, I would like to request of Senator Starr a motion to approve en bloc the following LCs.
So moved.
No, what?
Are we all of them?
LC21, LCA3, LC167, 247, 256, 266, 267, 268, 269, 271-1, 271-3, 272, 275, 277, 278, 279, 286, 399, 599, 605, 606, 609, 610, 611, 612, 650, 681, 682, 683, 684, 685, 688, 691, 692, 695, 697, 698, 856D, 1041D, 1042D, 1043D, 1044D, 1045D, 1046D, 1047D, 1048D, 1049D, 1076, 1116, 1117, oops, excuse me, delete what 1117, is that in?
We're expecting it.
Okay. 1117, 1118, 1119, 1120, 1121, 1122, 1134, 1150, 1151, 1152, 1242, 1265, 1357, 1435, 1436, 1437, 1438, 1439, 1478, 1533, 1544, 1545, 1563, 1564, 1594, 1599, 1600, 1601, 1666, 1740, 1823, 1844, 1852, 1867, 1945, 1958, 1959, 1960, 1961, 1962, 1966, 1987, 1284, 672, delete 672. 773, 774, 847, 851, 852, 681, 682, 683, 684, 685, 688, 691, 692, 695, 696, 697. And I would like to hold that motion because I just realized that we don't have Senator Beyer here. So, what do we do now? Do we just... Okay, I have a couple more to add. 1253, 1132, 2004, 1538, and 1351. That's just a description of the criminal's page. Okay, we will pause for a moment until we decide what we
want to do. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Is that all
seven.
We need? I thought we needed five. Okay.
Nope.
All right, Senator Starr, I have read some numbers of LCs and asked for a motion for those
first
introduced in block.
I move the LCs that you just read be introduced in block as committee bills.
Senator Starr has moved that the LCs that were previously read be introduced by the Senate Judiciary Committee on block. Are there any? Is there any discussion?
No, we have to call the roll.
Oh, wait, wait.
We call.
Oh, we actually have to call the roll. Okay. All right. Any discussion? All right. Call the roll, please.
Senator Prozanski.
Aye.
Senator Whitsitt?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Aye.
Chair Burdick?
Aye.
Passed.
Okay, well, thank you, Senator.
Okay, now on the House side. Looks like to that Representative Appelman, I would appreciate you moving as I read all these LCs in block form.
I will be so moved.
Okay, well, sorry. It would be LC 82, 85, 86, 87, 88, 90, 103, 129, 140, 178, 179, 180, 240, 293, 299, 300, 321, 607, 608, 645, 646, 648, 654, 674, 675, 676, 677, 686, 687, 689, 690, 693, 694, 699, 700, 701, 702, 741, 857D, 1032D, 1033D, 1034D, 1035D, 1036D, 1037D, 1038D, 1039D, 1040D, 1074, 1077, 1093, 1110, 1123, 1124, 1125, 1126, 1127, 1128, 1129, 1130, 1131, 1133, 1153, 1154, 1220, correction, 1236, 1340, 1589, 1622, 1623, 1655, 1656, 1663, 1739, 672, 673, 850, 772, 826, 845, 321, 672, 674, 675, 676, 677, 686, 687, 689, 690, 693, 694, 699.
I think you missed 691.
Representative. 699, 700, 701, 702, LC 1176, 81, 1548, and 1549.
Dash two and dash three.
Dash twos and dash threes on was 1176.
Pardon?
They're being introduced as dash two and dash three, two separate ones for 1176.
Was it 11? Okay.
Yeah, dash two.
Dash.
Yeah, you need 1176.
Dash. Okay.
Dash two, and dash three.
Okay, 1176 dash two and dash three. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, I would take it that if there's any ambiguity here, that we can look to the list that are before the committee concerning the bills and the record, and what particular, whether they're going to be a House or Senate bill.
That's right.
Yes.
What's on the list controls.
Then I have some additional ones as well. 1358, 672, 673, 850, 772, 826. Representative
Appelman,
can I have a motion for you then to accept?
Yes, so Mr. Chair, I will move that the LCs please be written into the record by... you be adopted in blank as committee bills.
Okay, thank you. Members, there's been a motion made by Representative Appelman to accept the LCs that I just mentioned as block.
You want to call roll?
Representative Ackerman.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Representative Cameron. Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Good man.
What's all about you, sorry?
Representative McPherson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson. Chair Olson.
Aye. Okay, the block of LCs have been adopted, so
okay, I will now, I think I left one out because of a paper hole punch that blocked LC 698.
You left that out.
Really good catch, Senator Starr. Senator Starr, would you like to make a motion on LC 698?
Madam Chair, I move that LC 698 be introduced as a committee bill.
Senator Starr has moved that LC 698 be introduced in the Senate Judiciary Committee bill. Is there any discussion? Patsy, please call the roll.
Senator Prozanski.
Aye.
Senator Wittsitt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr.
Aye.
Chair Burdick.
Aye. So introduced. And I will add for the record from the Senate side that if there are any ambiguities or omissions, that the list that's in our notebook will prevail in terms of introductions. Okay, now what? You done?
I'm done. Let's have a point of inquiry. During the Senator Johnson's presentation on behalf of the real estate task force, she mentioned that there were LCs that were either drafted or she wanted this committee to be the vehicle for those drafts. Were those incorporated in or mentioned in the bills previously?
1533 on the Senate.
Okay, fine. I couldn't read that fast.
It was my understanding that there would be others potential as well, but with that one.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
Oh, okay, just one bill, and it has been introduced. Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Prozanski.
I'm not sure regarding the list that we made reference to, if we just actually need to incorporate them in the record, or if they're already incorporated in the record. That's the only thing that you may want to make certain is done, since we're going to rely on that for any discrepancies. The list that you said are in the notebook,
mm-hmm.
That's part of the record.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Taylor.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, a couple of housekeeping matters. One, we've done a summary of the interim session, as we always do for leadership. We'll be sending a copy out to the chairs and a copy of the members and to the leadership, just summarizing what we've done during the interim. The other thing is that the co-chair, the chairs of respective committees have almost a punishment coming up, because you're going to have to sign each one of these bill backs.
Oh, I didn't know that when I
made the motion. And the other thing, Madam Chair,
that's where you get paid the big bucks.
I want to let the members know that I have a meeting with a lot of these people here on Friday and others to go over their bills for the purposes of identifying bills that could be heard early in session. The criteria are not likely to be amended and not likely to cause major heartburn. And it's just for the purposes of facilitating the session. We're already starting the plan. I want to let people know that. So.
Okay. Well, this is our last meeting of the interim, and I want to thank all the members of...
Before we do the final close, I would like to say something. Representative Ackerman, it's his last meeting as a legislator, and since he doesn't bake bread, I didn't buy him a plate. but I want to say I've really had a pleasure serving with him two terms on the Judiciary Committee in the House, and I really appreciate some of the legal insights he's had, where we've had a bill that just makes all the sense in the world. He'll say just a second to explain why it's completely sideways, and other than being just a great all-around guy, he's a great legal mind on that committee, and I really appreciate working with you. Your service to the state and your willingness to do that, and then move on.
I would like to echo that too, and I will say that your legal acumen and determination and diligence were a real asset on the Senate side as well in a number of cases.
I thank both of you for that. It's been a great pleasure to serve, and it's been a great challenge, and I think we've all worked together for the benefit of the state of Oregon, and I think that's what I'm most proud of. Thank you.
Great. You've done a great job. And Senator Starr, we'll miss you very much.
Know that I will miss
the opportunity to fellowship, the issues that we face together, and that I'm determined to continue to make a difference in this state for the good of our citizens. And I thank you for bearing with me, eating the product of my kitchen, and
yum yum yum.
it's been fun. It's been a decided pleasure to serve. Certainly, I have never done anything I've enjoyed more. Sometimes frustrated, but very much enjoyed the opportunity to serve the people.
Thank you very much, and you did it well. And I want to thank all the members of the both committees, and the Senate in particular. And now, on behalf of the Senate, unless there are parting comments, we will adjourn the Senate, and I will turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Senator. I do want to close just quickly here, too, Representative Appleman. I mean, you got to understand what happened last session. You've got three police officers in there. We're trying to get two attorneys squared away and everything. Actually, I'll tell you, it was a neat time for me, being my rookie season, and I absolutely depended on Bob Ackerman, and I greatly appreciated Greg McPherson as well being there for me. You are truly somebody I look up to, and I do mean that. But I do appreciate your help, and I hope you will just really enjoy yourself back down there in Eugene.
Thank you.
Just don't come north.
Well, I feel we made you police officers are pretty good lawyers.
Mr. Chair, if I could just second those remarks about Representative Ackerman. It's been my honor to serve with him and to be with an education to watch him in action through a couple of sessions of the Judiciary Committee, and we'll be the poorer for not having that kind of guidance in the future.
Sure. Okay, with that then, the House is adjourned.